I didn't think up an intro for the show this week. So, welcome to the show. Have a seat. This is Radio Free Nintendo, and it's
July 14th.
It is, yes. And I am your host, James Jones. Don't sit there. That's the nice couch. Sit on the one with the plastic on it. John Lindemann.
So, am I being led to believe that this is therapy, James?
It's an intervention. Right. And our friends, Mr. Greg Leahy.
Oi, oi, everyone.
Greg, tell John why you're worried about him.
It's non-judgmental, all right? That's all I know about interventions.
It's not about judgment. It's what you're worried about.
Yeah, that's all I know about it. Beyond that, I don't know how to participate.
Also, John, Mr. Guillaume Vayette is also worried about you.
Yeah, well, we've only got 2 hours, so I don't know if we can actually get into what's wrong with John, but... Mm-hmm.
It's not what's wrong. It's what we want to help him get through together.
This is a terrible intervention so far. I'd just like to say that.
All right, so this is Radio Free Nintendo episode 485, The Intervention, and we are here to talk about the only thing that matters in the world of Nintendo, Pokemon Go, apparently, but not right now. That comes later. First, Guillaume, welcome back.
Hey.
You and I guess I have Nintendo's biggest game until last week to talk about.
Yeah, well, yeah. I've been also playing Tokyo Mirage Sessions Sharp FE. You know, like 2 weeks ago, I mentioned how I read some reviews and I got hyped. And I was like, yes, I'm going to play this awesome game. Which is like super anime and where, you know, people transforms and sing duets and you know, chuck spears at each other. And then I actually played it and reality kind of set in, like, when... because I gotta say, like, especially 2 weeks ago, like, you're kind of... when you introduced the game, James, like, you said that it was, you know, like, you could almost not comprehend it. But then you backtracked. Like, so, you said, well, like, oh, this is blowing my mind, but not that much, you know?
Yes, yeah, so it's a situation of there is kind of this sense of, like, there's stuff in this game, and at a high level, I understand what's happening. And thematically, I mostly understand what's happening. But when I get down into it, it's just like, I don't know, here's stuff. Even things like the core gameplay hook sometimes, you're like, what are you doing right now?
Right. I think that personally, like, talking about the game, I would stress how kind of formulaic it is. And I would translate the phrase anime is happening not as, like, you know, like crazy shit is happening, but as like stuff you've seen before and that is kind of trite and tropey is happening.
I mean, that's all part and parcel with anime is happening.
Yeah, like, but I guess, like, I was not interpreting it that way before. And now I understand, like, okay, anime is happening. That means,
every anime that you've ever seen is happening.
No, very specific subset of all the animes you've ever seen are happening. Like, this is, like, there is a very weird, palpable, like, monster of the week sense to this game. It is very much, that kind of genre. You know, there is quite literally episodic flow to the game, mm-hmm. where it's, you meet somebody, bad thing happens to them, monster, the team powers up, transforms, goes to the monster, fights it, rescues new friend either joins the team or becomes sort of an ancillary character to the team, game proceeds. Like, it very much follows that riff, but in the middle of it, There are these weird, like, intermission segments that are, like, slice of life side story anime. Like, it's really kind of following two beats between, you know, the main chapter and the side story. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you've got the game systems where some of them are well explained, some of them are not well explained. I still don't understand how to tell when my stage rank is about to level up. I just keep grinding on it till it does. But there is kind of, like, there is definitely a rhythm to this game. And that was, I mean, when you read what the people making the game were looking out to do, that was their objective. They wanted to get the, I mean, we talked about cadence last week. We mentioned it with respect to Zelda, and I used the counterexample of, like, an Indiana Jones film. They took the cadence of a Monster of the Week anime and followed it down to the letter. They took the cadence of these weird, like, subgenre of slices life animes, and like each of the little side stories sort of encompasses one. There's a problem, the characters meet to talk about it, they formulate a plan to solve the problem, the plan goes sideways, they achieve the plan anyway, success, everyone's happy, power of friendship.
Right, exactly, power of friendship, yeah. So one of the problems I have with the game is the characters, actually, because the main protagonist is about as interesting as an unflavored block of tofu. He's just not doing much. Like, he's the kind of very tropey again. Like, it's the main character of Persona 4, for instance, is kind of like that too. Like, he's kind of like the person that you can project yourself onto, you know?
Link syndrome here.
Right. So he's got, you know, like, he's just basically like an all around good guy that everyone just really likes and that all the girls are into, apparently. And, for no discernible reason, like, it's not like he's got a personality or anything. So, like, his role, I guess, is that he brings the gang together. Like, he supports the other characters and, you know, like, they're like, oh, I'm so glad that you're here to help me with this thing. And,
Find a cat.
God, yeah, I need to find a cat to discover what being cute is, or no.
Devilishly charming.
Devilishly charming, yeah, she needs to become a tease or something. Like, she needs to, yeah.
You want me, and I'm going to make you think I want you, but I don't.
Right, so, yeah. So, and somehow, like, you're the main character helps her with that, but it's not really clear to me how. Like,
he finds the cat.
That's
what he does.
Yeah, except for being the sucker who kind of traveled all around Shibuya to find a freaking cat. So he's not very interesting. So you've got, you know, and then, like, you've got the rest of the cast, which has, you know, that's an actual example that we use. Like, she needs to discover, like, how to be sexy and you know, kind of make viewers want more or something so that she can star in this commercial for a beverage and ace it.
Yes.
And then you get to see the commercial and it's just her, you know, running around in the bikini and being, you know, like, there's waves everywhere and she's just like, haha, you know, like, this drink is awesome.
Flirty wink at the end. You got it. That was right. Important. That was the whole reason she followed the cat for like 4 hours.
Yeah. So it's just like, okay, like, this is kind of silly, but at the same time, it's not as, I don't know, it's not as funny as I hoped it would be. It's not as, there's nothing really clever to it. There's not, I don't know.
I was actually kind of amused by that. I mean,
Into specific segments. Well, you kind of have to be because they really, really want you to be.
Yeah, there's a whole segment of her basically interviewing the cat is weird and silly. I mean, it's you're right. Your character is the straight man,
mm-hmm.
and everyone around him is some degree of a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, she is this hyper innocent, doesn't know anything, like, has no concept of the real world, adorable, doesn't want to do anything wrong, kind of perfect child. And you know, your best friend is kind of a doofus. Like, he's supposed to be really cool, but at the right. same time, like, he's super into children's action shows and wants to be the star of one. Another girl on your team is hyper stuck up.
So she's the only one who's kind of side quests I finished, or line of side quests. So I finished her arc, and I'm pretty much as unimpressed with it as I was at the beginning. So I tweeted a little bit about it. I said that Kiria, she's kind of like the cool, tough chick, but she's got a sensitive side, but she doesn't want to admit to it.
I actually meant Ellie.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. Anyway, I'm thinking of Kiria here.
Who's not cool and is also stuck up.
Right, yeah. So I was tweeting about it, saying that it was kind of disappointing that Kiria's problem of not wanting to admit to herself that she likes cute stuff is not an actual problem. And Seren kind of, you know, was like, well, I disagree with everything in that tweet, you know? Like, She really liked that character arc, and now that I finished it, I can kind of see why, because the character arc is not so much, like, I don't want to admit that I like things as much as it's kind of her kind of, like, defining or discovering what her personality is, which can be, you know, like, a good lesson. Like, it can be... That's a character arc, for sure. But the way that it's approached with, like, this girl who's like, oh, like... Someone said once that I like cute stuff is stupid, and I like cute stuff, and that from then on, like, I just wanted to project like a tough exterior, and like, let's go kill cute monsters so that once we do that, I'm gonna stop being into cute stuff. Like, that's a bad way to approach like a good topic. There's multiple stories that you could write about someone who refuses to accept who they are, and actually, there's several of them dealt with a much better way in games like Persona 4. In this game, it's just, there's nothing to hang on to with these characters, you know? Like, there's nothing to really root for or anything. Like, they're just kind of dumb and pointless.
So they do fall into the category of pretty people with problems. But
right.
At the same time, like, for me, the problem isn't the story hooks. Like, I can deal with the story. There's some of it I've liked. You know, I enjoyed the whole arc of that, you know, this one character who wants to be a singer is instead hosting a show about cooking. That doesn't appear to be a particularly involved show about cooking, and yet your weird, crazy, you know, coach is her biggest fan and constantly forgets his phone charger in order to borrow hers because she is an angel too pure for this world. Like, all that shit is weird, and I enjoy that it being weird. For me, the problem I'm having with this game is the hooks are paced really slow.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I'm playing through a dungeon. The dungeons don't move at a very fast pace. You could spend a long time in them. That's
fine.
Well,
you have to solve puzzles while you're going through them. And so there's a lot of steps to do. There's a lot of... Yeah, you're advancing very slowly in the dungeons. But they're still my favorite part of the game, to be honest.
It's a little bit Etrian like that, where the dungeons can take a really long time to get through, even though they're not very big.
Right.
But the hooks to get through them can be really slow. And sometimes that feels disheartening when you're spending a lot of time getting not very far. And there is sort of this sense of, like, I need to use the repel, because otherwise I'm going to have to fight these same boneheads over and over again, and it's just going to drain my magic. And then I'm going to have to leave the dungeon and go back into the dungeon. And that can be kind of like, oh, here we go.
Oh, yeah, because everything is everywhere you need to be for a side quest or that you need to find for a character or anything like that is, like, 4 or 5 load screens away. Like,
yes.
and it really, like, it's really killing the pacing of this game.
And that's kind of the thing it is. So, like, okay, I need to go to Shibuya to go meet with Shibuya and meet with somebody. Okay. I have to leave the studio. Or I have to leave the office. When I'm in Shibuya, I have a button to essentially launch the quick jump screen. But in the office, fuck you. No, you don't.
Yeah.
Maybe you're in, you know, a room in the office. So you have to leave that room. Then you have to leave the office. Then you get a loading screen both places. Then you go to the map. You pick Shibuya. You pick where you want to go there. Loading screen.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the person. You talk to them.
The dialogue is slow, you know, and you have to get, like, it takes a while to get through it. There's too much of it. There's too much text.
I can read pretty fast. So I'm blasting through it pretty quick. So that doesn't bother me so much. But just, you know, like, even saving the game takes too long.
Mm.
And here's the thing, we're being harsh on this game.
Yeah, sorry, like, I didn't mean to just shit on the game, but
yeah, like, I enjoy this game.
It's so flawed.
it's flawed in a way that I appreciate the game, and it's not hurting the game per se. It's just hard for me to keep hard gameplay hours in it. So, like, after an hour or two of this game, I kind of feel like, okay, I'm gonna put it down for a while.
Yeah, I had the Monday off, and I was planning on spending the day, like, playing that game, and that kind of changed. Like, after a while, I was just like, okay, this is getting tedious. I think I spent 2 hours doing just stupid fetch quests and didn't get to the next dungeon. I was like, okay, like, I'm going to do something else.
Yeah, but it's sort of the opposite of how I consume RPGs. I usually play them for extended hours, you know, 4, 5,
right.
6 hours, because they're relatively... Not mind-free, but relatively untaxing to play.
Mm.
Like Seventh Dragon, which we'll briefly mention in a second.
Yeah, well, if like I would like to compare them right now because like Seventh Dragon is very much, you know, I think that there's a lot that Seventh Dragon doesn't do particularly well, but there's one thing that it does really, really well, and it's the dragon encounters. And I think that the people who made Seventh Dragon knew that, and they made sure to keep you fighting frigging dragons, you know?
Oh, especially late in the game, which is like, there's 19 dragons in this room. You just think, fuck off, no, I don't want to deal with this.
Well, I did, though. You do. I really, yeah. And but that's the thing, like, the Seventh Dragon has side quests, has, you know, stupid NPCs that you don't actually care for, and all that stuff. But Seventh Dragon, like, the difference would be the side quest that you're doing for this NPC that you don't care for. It's, you know, it leads usually to you fighting a freaking dragon, you know? Like, it leads you to do the thing that's fun about the game.
And not the dragons you fought, like, 35 times.
Right, like some sort of new dragon with, like, different attacks, maybe, like, a new look and everything. Like, it's a new fight and, like a brand new boss battle, usually, right? And that's what is fun about the game. So the game keeps you doing that one thing. And Tokyo Mirage Sessions, that, like, the fetch quests are not very good, and the game keeps you doing that. The game doesn't stick to its strengths.
I will say that I actually like the combat system. This is where Seren's, like, if the game's on harder, it makes it more enjoyable because.
Yeah, well, I'm playing on hard. It's not that different from the fighting system in Persona or Shin Megami Tensei 4. It's got the hook of, like, having, like, these combos, like, all your teammates are jumping into.
And there's more type stuff built on top of it because of other stuff on top of.
Right.
But, well, the thing that gets me about it, though, and this is going to sound weird, is that enemies have too many weaknesses.
Hmm.
And I say that because it seems like there's almost, it seems like there's almost always in the fight, whatever character I have in the party out, there's almost always something they can hit and trigger a combo. And I think because they wanted to show off the combo system. But the fact is, I can swap party members on a whim. Like, yeah. I can just hit the button and swap them and use the turn. And if that's the case, I wish the game forced my hand to do that more, because then I'd really have to think about what my plan is. Because if I'm going to say, I'm going to go ahead and swap in Toma now, well, what if I want to swap in Toma, or what if I need to get Kiria out of the battle? Who do I put in her place? So maybe I don't want to swap in Toma right now. Maybe I want to swap him in a second, because right now, Toma can't contribute to the combo I'm going to trigger on the next move. But he can contribute once I swap him. But the game doesn't force you to think about that, because almost everybody can combo with almost everybody else.
Well, I'm glad that you don't have to swap in a lot of characters, because there's a load time associated with that too. So,
well, assuming that worked better. But, yeah. Like, there was an opportunity there to make the combat system more complicated by making the type system making you have to think about it more.
Well, there was one dungeon, like, I think the second, chapter two, at some point where some enemies repelled attacks, and all of a sudden, if I triggered certain combos at some point, it would turn against me. So I thought, like, oh, okay, that's cool. Okay, so I have to watch out for these enemies. I have to perhaps, you know, make sure to weaken them first and then make sure that they get killed during the combo before it gets to that attack. And then perhaps, like, I can keep the combo going on the next character. Because when you kill one enemy and then the combo automatically switches to the next one, then the repel, I've noticed, doesn't work. Like, your combo can keep going. So I thought, like, okay, like, some strategy. That's cool. But then it hasn't happened again. You know, like, that type of challenge hasn't really popped up again. And I'm in chapter four.
Yeah, I know what dungeon you're talking about. It was the electric attacks would always get reflected back, but they were getting reflected back at a person who's basically resistant to them anyway. So I basically just said, screw it, I don't care.
Oh.
50 damage, great. He's got like 800 health. Who gives a crap?
Right.
But there is a certain amount of, like, the combat system doesn't feel like it has a challenge to it, except for kind of the boss fights. But even then, they're relatively straightforward. I like the bosses a lot. Like, I like their design. They are sufficiently haunting, usually.
Sure.
I wouldn't say they're, like, they're certainly an acquired taste. But there is a sense to a lot of them, like, this shit's weird. I'm enjoying this. This makes me happy. To them, that makes me wish they were kind of more frequent. Like, you got to see more of them.
Yeah.
But I understand that they're also if they're gonna follow the monster of the week cadence, you have to fight them at the end. Like, that's where they belong, and if that's what they're going for, that's why they're there.
Yeah, and the game does give you one or two mid bosses. That's good. But yeah. I don't know. Like, what keeps me playing this game? The podcast, I guess.
That's but sad. Also,
but also, I, you know, like, once I get in the dungeon, like, when I start one and the game doesn't force me to trek out of it, and that has happened in chapter 4. Like, sometimes my characters were, like, having a discussion, like, oh, we have to turn back because, Tsubasa, doesn't know how to act. And that's happened twice, you know? And
chapter, it's like, chapter 2, it happens as well.
Right. And I'm just like, really? Like, I can go right now. Like, I've got full, my magic points are full. Like, I can take on a boss right now, but you want me to get out of the dungeon just because, like, of a story thing. So that's annoying. But when I start dungeon, the game allows me to stay in the dungeon and kind of, like, work it out and, like, solve the puzzles so I enjoy those moments, but almost everything else around those moments, I'm not really into.
So, as a counter, I'm enjoying the game. I'm just struggling with it because I'm not able to get into long-term play hooks. You know, stuff like when you're getting text messages all the freaking time, and you're stopping to read these stupid things.
That's the part that everyone loved about GTA 4, right? Your annoying friends that call you on your cell all the time.
So, like, in this case, it's like, hey, you got this one item that you needed for, like, 9 fusions, so I'm going to go ahead and text you about all of them. Great. There is something to this game that I'm enjoying. There's a lot of stuff this game I'm enjoying. And when I sit down and play it, there are times where I'm into it. I just can't dig into it for long stretches of time. And maybe that's in part because it is episodic. Maybe because it's got the beat points of something that is normally consumed episodically, i.e. the anime it's working from, the models it's working from, it actually does contribute to me kind of feeling like, okay, time for me to punch out for a little while. I don't know. And it's not something I'm used to with an RPG. So that's why I'm not putting the time in. Like, I would have expected, having had this game for about 2 weeks and some change, to be at the 30 to 35 hour point, if not more. And I'm really just in the low 20s, which is kind of a testament to, like, the dig in that this game is just not having. And I had a 3-day weekend at some point there. So I would, by Xenoblade, I would have already had like 80 hours into it at this point. So
are you, like, this is from the director of that time traveling RPG. What is it?
Yeah. Radiant Historia.
Radiant Historia. So do you see, like, any kind of parallels between the two titles? Like, do you find, is there a connection there, you know?
Not that I have seen, not really. I see the care. Like, this game has a tremendous amount of care put into it.
Oh,
like,
sure.
Regardless of how we feel about the game, and I'm liking it and you seem pretty ambivalent on it, you can see that somebody fucking cared. This was a labor of love for somebody. It, all over the place. In, you know, the Hiho Mart, which is a great reference to Jack Frost, because that's what he says in the Japanese Shin Megami Tensei games. But, like, the fact that the person doing the sales is Anna from Fire Emblem, the person who does the sales in the Fire Emblem games, and that her persona is just Anna wearing a Jack Frost mask and talking obnoxiously. Like, somebody really sat down and said, I want to world build here. And they did it. And they world built the hell out of this game. And it's everywhere. You know, the fact that as your friends put out new singles, you start seeing the poster for their new single on the wall, and the music playing from the wafting out of the stores changes to be their new song.
Right.
Like,
yeah, so I enjoyed that. And perhaps, like, the reason why I'm not into the world building as much is also because I'm not as familiar with Fire Emblem. Yeah.
You know, I think I'll probably have at least one more session of this, pun not intended, for this game. You know, on the show, and hopefully it'll be more concluding thoughts, probably not for another week or two, you know, give it some time to finish up. But I wouldn't discourage somebody from getting this game. I think this game is interesting as its own thing. I definitely think, you know, read into what this game is before you go in. I am enjoying it, and I have a very positive feeling about this game. Like I said, for me, it's just the riffs aren't working quite right, but it's fine. We'll get through it. Guillaume, it seems like you're more ambivalent on that, but
well,
it's still... Go ahead.
I was going to say that Karen needed some comfort food TV and subscribed to Crunchyroll for like the trial period for 2 weeks and kind of blazed through Sailor Moon. And I would say that was a better use of someone's time than playing this. Like, if you want anime that is happening, watch some anime. You're probably going to be more satisfied.
Fair enough. All right. So I did want to mention, Guillaume and I, since we can now officially give reviews, even though we don't do reviews, of Seventh Dragon, I strongly recommend you go procure this game now that it is out.
I can finally say it's total garbage.
Great.
No, it's no, like, yeah, I probably spoke too much about the game already, but yeah, it's just, I really enjoy it. Like, if you love a good combat system, like, as I've described, like, it just makes you feel like a badass when you set up everything correctly. It's really good. It's just, expect a game that's really, really, really linear, like, to a fault. Like, you have a path and you don't deviate from it.
I mean, except to go hunt dragons, but you can potentially clear all those out on your first pass anyway, so.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And, so, should I talk very briefly about the TurboGrafx on Wii U?
Can we do it in 3 minutes or less?
Yeah, sure. No, I just want to mention that, so that came out kind of out of nowhere. So
yeah,
finally,
it's been there. It had it in Japan with you for so long. Really,
right.
Just kind of gone past hoping it was going to show
right.
up anywhere
we
else.
Assumed
like, why
the
now?
License.
Yeah, Guillaume, I mean, apparently whenever Guillaume starts talking about Hudson titles now, it's just like magic.
Apparently, yeah.
It's like, I love so,
magical
Legendary
racism.
Axe, Adventure Island, and...
Yeah, I don't think Legendary Axe was ever in the Virtual Console in North America, but maybe this time. I don't know.
Yeah.
What came out are games that already came out on the Wii Virtual Console. There's the first bunk, New Adventure Island, which is kind of a different title from the other, you know, like it's a game
a
in
one.
Itself.
It's got also a pre-rendered look and goes, ba, ba.
Now with more racist.
Wait, no, it doesn't really, no, it's more of a cartoony... It's more of a cartoony look. I think you're thinking of Adventure Island: The Beginning, which
was
the
I'm thinking
the
of New
Wii
Super
Wear.
Mario Brothers. Mm. That's the gag.
I'm sorry. I've got 3 minutes here, man.
now you know my pain, Guillaume. This always happens.
So yeah, New Adventure Island, which I really recommend. It's probably one of the better Adventure Island titles. You run to the right and you chuck tomahawks and you've got this timer, fruit timer thing, so you gotta, you know, make it to the end of the level before Master Higgins gets hungry, I guess. And it's really pretty, like very like cartoony, lush, like, you know, very colorful. So that's the one I recommend of the initial batch. But the game I got is Bunk's Adventure or whatever the first Bunk game is called, because I had skipped it. Because I had been told that it was a little bit, you know, kind of bare bones and not as good as the sequels. And
it's the first game in a series.
Yeah, and it's, I gotta say, people were right. It's not as good as the rest. But the Virtual Console, pretty good. Like, it's got a decent set of options. It's funny because I posted pictures of the Virtual Console menu on Twitter, and immediately I had, like, I don't know, like 20 likes, and that never happens. So I think that Emily Rogers like retweeted it, and yeah, she's got a lot of followers. But apparently, there's like this like pent up like I don't know. There's this hunger for TurboGrafx-16 on the Wii U. So
I think
I'm
the
glad
other thing
that...
is that the thing with Wii U Virtual Consoles, it's a bit varied in terms of the quality of the emulation and everything. You know, like.
Right.
NES and Super NES is not great, and then GBA is great, and, you know, it's, I think people are kind of eager to say, okay, like, you know, if they haven't, like, read up on this stuff from Japan,
right.
What is it like? You know, is it sort of as kind of full-featured as you might hope?
Yeah, well, just as the other games on the Wii U Virtual Console, you can remap the buttons on the gamepad and then use different controllers. You can, you've got the restore points that you can create. But you've also got like graphical settings where you can change a screen mode. So I didn't check what the other modes other than default were, but default is like 4x3. kind of, you know, like old school. But you can, like, you've got options you've never seen in a virtual console game before, like the display position, like vertical and horizontal, the screen size, the screen ratio, like all of these, like, can be individually changed. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, it's
pretty
cool.
Oh, you know, then you need Tartai mode for all those vertical shooters.
Oh, God.
Right. So, so it's got a few more options than usual, but apparently those come at a price. There's a Konami tax on the upgrade fee for TurboGrafx-16 games. So if you already bought these games on the Wii Virtual Console, you have to pay, in Canada anyway, $3 to upgrade. And if you're buying them brand new, they're $6. They're the same price.
Yeah,
as
so it's like that ratio is out of whack, isn't it? Because that's half, whereas normally it's a lot less than half.
Yeah, like Super Nintendo games were like $1.50 and, or, you know, for an $8 game.
Yeah.
So it's a, Konami decided that they wanted to screw people, which is
May be that, you know, they kind of feel like a lot of the people that are going to get these at all are people that are going to upgrade. You know, like they've looked at the kind of the likelihood of the kinds of people that are going to get these and just feel like, well, if we charge them a minimal price, then we're going to get nothing out of it whatsoever. So we better do this, you know, because it's not as going to be as mainstream type of stuff as the, you know, the Mario games and all this, you know, that would be on NES, Super NES, you know, sort of high profile hits.
Yeah, I just prefer to think that Konami is deliberately being dicks, and
always tempting to think that way.
It's never quite out of the realm of possibility.
Let me introduce you to a man named Hideo Kojima, who is forbidden from taking awards for his own game.
And I know, but like, not only is Konami like messing with people on purpose, in my opinion, but also like they want people to know it, because in a nice bit of revisionist history, when you load up a TurboGrafx-16 game on the Wii U, you've got that loading screen, right? But you've got also like the Konami like 16-bit sound that rings. And of course, Konami had nothing to do with TurboGrafx-16, so...
Nope.
Except put out, like, 3 games on it.
Right.
Like, not even that many. They weren't even that active, relatively speaking.
Yeah, so I thought, like, oh, okay, nice, Konami. Like, that's really eliciting nostalgia that I hear your Konami sound when I'm loading up Bunk, you know?
I do bloody love that sound.
I hope they get stung to death by hundreds of Japanese wasps.
I'd be quite happy to accompany, you know, a lot of things in while opening the fridge. You know, also, so, I mean, I'm all for it, to be honest.
We can make that happen. All it's going to take is like a small microcomputer and a speaker, and we're good to go.
Every time
you start your vehicle.
So that's the TurboGrafx-16.
The other one's R-Type, right? The other which is actually a little more expensive, because technically in Japan that came on 2 HU cards, whereas elsewhere it came on 1. But then they sort of held over the fact that this was like a special jumbo size PC Engine game, so it's slightly more expensive. It's a good version of R-Type though. Fair play.
I'll pick it up. I like R-Type a lot.
It's pretty challenging. I can't remember where I stopped.
I want to say that before the show, I was ranting about HU cards, completely unrelated to this. So great, this is awesome. Like, I like that Konami just said, no, this game that's digital, that has no bearing on the fact that it came on fucking pieces of plastic, we're still going to charge you more for it, even though it's totally irrelevant. This is what the virtual console experience should be. Taxes for games that were larger in physical media that still come out to probably less than 5 megabytes. Oh. Why the fuck do we allow Konami to continue to exist?
Yeah, I know. I don't know why they're still an entity.
Why can't they be stopped? All right. Greg.
Yes. So, I've got Hyrule Warriors Legends to talk about this week, which was not a purchase I was particularly planning on making, I have to say. For context, I did have the Wii U game, when it came out. So, you know, I played that quite a lot, actually. Very much an off-TV play game, that one. It's kind of a snack food game to me.
Oh, totally.
It's not something that I want to play for like hours on end. Yeah, cause it is pretty simple, kind of repetitive stuff. And not something that requires necessarily absolute full attention either, you know, but in an off TV play setting, it was probably pretty, suitable. And I ended up racking, you know, it took a long time in terms of, you know, sort of months and stuff, but I ended up racking quite a lot of hours of game time in it, doing some of the extra stuff like adventure mode and all that. So kind of felt like I was done with that game, but you know, I did at the same time feel like it, the gameplay was a pretty good fit for a portable. You know, it was good to obviously, you know, taking off TV plays, it's kind of logical conclusion, if you like. And then it just, an opportunity came up to get it really, really affordably. Basically, to put it in context, it was like a little over the face value of the DLC from the game that's available on Wii U now. So, you know, I could buy that so I bought the physical game, which has that DLC code in it, you know, put that on my Wii U game, play this and then move it on if I don't want to keep it. And it's pretty much, that is pretty much a wash at that point. Before you even take into account whatever, you know, I get back on the game, if I wanted to trade it in or sell it or whatever. So yeah, I thought, why not? You know, it's got some new content in it. It's been a while since I played a bunch of Hyrule Warriors. So let's dive back in and see what it's like. And yeah, I wasn't relishing the idea of playing through the campaign again to unlock some of the new stuff. You know, because it's like, well, I did play that one, so I enjoyed it to some extent, you know, but not desperate to do it again. But you know, kind of, it wasn't necessarily just a straight slog through stuff I'd done before to get to it. Cause I mean, on kind of the adventure mode and all that, you can kind of do in parallel to some extent. I could use new characters I hadn't used before, a lot of the time, sort of as I was unlocking it. Although I was a bit curbed by the fact that the way they've distributed some of the unlockables now is like, you can't unlock like the sort of second tier of weapons for characters until you open up the second adventure map, which is the Wind Waker themed one. So yeah, you kind of unlock characters, but they feel a bit, you know, it's kind of a bit of a chore to make yourself use them at first, because you've got characters that have better weapons than from ones that are unlocked in the campaign, like the kind of the main characters. Like obviously Link gets the Master Sword, which is very powerful, and you know, some of the other characters get better weapons too. So that choice, I'm not sure about the wisdom of it in general, but it would definitely wasn't that great for someone like me that kind of wanted to use the new characters as much as possible, as early as possible. But there are some good ones in there. I think it's kind of impressive. I mean, there's like, I've unlocked 25 characters in the game, you know, which I think that's all of the characters in the game before they've started and more rounds of DLC, like the Link's Awakening pack, that recently came out with Marin and all that. But, you know, it's impressive that, you know, considering there was already a ton of characters in it, that some of these do actually feel, you know, in as much as they can in this sort of pretty constrained, sort of simplistic framework of the Musou kind of gameplay style. Like they add something, like, I mean, some of these things are unique to Legends and some of them aren't, but I didn't have any of the DLC on Wii U because I was satisfied with the game as it was without having to pay for more. But you know, like Link on the horse is great. It feels quite different from the other characters. Linkle is weird. She's got the sort of the strong attack, puts you into this over the shoulder, like she's John Wooing with the double crossbows, mowing down things. Like they do have like feel a little more novel than I was expecting, to be honest. Because ultimately, it's just, you know, pressing the same sort of button combinations to make stuff happen. But, you know, I was pretty pleased with the characters. But the real thing that I was kind of looking for, and this is what, you know, never has been in the DLC, is the actual new battlegrounds, the new maps, you know, the characters you can have and, you know, costume packs and all this kind of stuff, and maybe new challenges and stuff. But actually new locations you know, to have as battlegrounds, and you know, the way they incorporate those into the sort of the layout of the levels and stuff. I think it's actually one of the game's strengths. You know, a lot of the way they kind of work in those Zelda locations is really cool. Mm. When you recognize things from a game, if you're playing on the Twilight Realm level and you recognize, you know, the throne that Zant sits on when Midna pops him like a balloon, you know, just, or like, the Lake Hylia one where, you know, it kind of incorporates the outside and then the water temple inside and all this, you know, there's a real attention to detail there. So the idea of getting a little more of that was appealing. And in this case, it's the Wind Waker stuff that's like totally new in that area. And you get two very nice sort of Wind Waker maps that are actually kind of amalgams of different Wind Waker locations. One that's kind of exterior locations, and then another which is the latter two dungeons from that game kind of smashed into one. And you actually get some layer sort of design there where they use the fact that there are some new features in this, like the ability to switch characters on the fly on the battlefield, which is a nice change because, you know, it cuts out some of that just kind of running around putting out fires thing that it can dominate the gameplay sometime. You know, it's like, well,
right,
this keeps about a fall, or this character needs to be rescued, and it's on the different parts of the map, and you've got to just spend a fair amount of the time playing the level just running between those places. Now you might have different characters that will be in those places. Just, you know, press on the touchscreen that character icon, warp straight to it, and you know, that feels like, you know, it's kind of eliminating some filler in the battles when you could do that. And also, even with an individual character, you can have owl statues, which if you activate, you can then use an ocarina item to walk between those places. So yeah, that actually kind of freshened up the campaign a bit more, even the levels that I had played before, more than I was expecting. Kind of made it, you know, a breezier kind of experience playing through all that. And then, yeah, the new levels, they really seem more designed with that stuff in mind and were even, you know, a little bit more interesting. It's just a shame there wasn't a bit more of it, really. You know, as I said, it's just two, and you get a couple of new bosses, to go with it as well, which is nice, because again, that's another thing you get fatigued of, is fighting the same bosses again and again if you're doing adventure maps or whatever. You know, it definitely needed some extra bosses, and it's nice that you've got a couple here. But you know, it's still the same game, it's still the Musos and Formula, so I imagine a lot of people are gonna, you know whether they you know, particularly into that or not. But
right,
I guess the biggest thing it loses in the transition to 3DS is the flash. The Wii U game is a good looking game, lots of flashy impressive stuff. You know, in this case, you know, obviously it has to lose quite a lot of that with the you know, squeezing it onto 3DS. Now I've been playing it on a new 3DS, in which case if you're playing on in 2D, it runs well enough. You know, it's pretty playable and it looks okay. Normally I'm a 3D all the time kind of person with 3DS, but in this case, the hit's just too big. It's, you know, the frame rate. Any time, maybe if you're playing an adventure map where it's like one of those ones where you just have to fight like a couple of guys at once or something, it's okay. But in the normal flow of things where there's hordes of stuff all around all the time, it just can't. It can't really handle it to make it worthwhile to keep the 3D on. And of course, if you're playing on a regular 3DS, you're pre the new models, then it can't even do 3D at all. And it still apparently runs really poorly. So yeah, this is maybe a sort of de facto exclusive for that system. I don't know, but you know, it plays pretty well in 2D on a new 3DS, that's what I'd say. But it does lose a lot of that kind of gloss that it had before. But I guess, you know, considering I've already seen that, that's, you know, to a large extent, it's not such a big loss. in that sense. It's just kind of like when I was playing on Wii U, eventually I was just playing on the gamepad screen by itself, and, you know, obviously it loses a fair bit of its spectacle in that transition too. So it's just kind of an extension of that, really. But, you know, I've moved on to just adventure map kind of stuff at this point. The campaign's done. I play through Linkle's levels, which, I mean, Linkle is a fun character to use, definitely, but the actual levels are just kind of, you know, fiddling around with existing maps. There's not really much there. That's terribly interesting, but except the chance to sort of use a character for the first time, which is, yeah, pretty unique with the crossbows and bombs and all kind of crazy stuff that she does. But I'm into the sort of, the thing with the adventure maps, I feel like, and this just goes back to Wii U as well, of course, is just that I wish the challenges were all quicker. You know, if they, I think the problem I find with the adventure map is it seems like it's kind of based on this idea of having these quick challenges, because it's got these kind of grindy elements in there of, you know, like, well, oh, you need a compass to show you what bit of the map needs to be blown up to reveal the reward for that square. And then you need to have a bomb to blow it up, you know, and that's going to involve playing, you know, these challenges and stuff. And that would be more palatable if they actually were short, but a lot of the time, you know, you'll have ones where if you're going to get an A rank, you know, you can get an A rank by playing it for 14 minutes. You know, it's not that quick, especially with it being, you know, actually portable now. And I think, you know, in the regular game, you could save during a mission, but on adventure maps, you can't. So it really sort of demands, quicker sort of bite-sized challenges. And with the new map, the Wind Waker one that I'm playing through now, a lot of them are a bit quicker, which is good. But certainly going through the first adventure map is not so much the case. And, you know, there's still a fair amount of these that are just like, I just feel like, you know, isn't that what the campaign's for? You know, well, I on the one hand, I wouldn't want them to all be like the really ultra quick ones where it's just like, oh, here's three rooms of, you know, fighting a couple of guys and that's it. But it just, I don't know, it feels like there's a bit of redundancy there to me.
Well, and I was hoping that in this version of the game, although I have no intention of buying it, that they would have tuned down these stages, because some of the stages in the Wii U game can be quite long.
Yeah, absolutely. These are at least as long. Maybe, like I said, it'd probably be a bit quicker playing the old stages with maybe some of the character swapping I was talking about.
Right.
But still, in general, it's not, like I said, you know, it's not the most that part of it's not the best suited to portable play, except they do have a pretty robust kind of almost like a suspend type of save in the middle of a mission when you're playing on the legend mode, the sort of the main campaign, but the adventure map doesn't support that as far as I could see. So that's odd, to say the least.
That is odd. All right. So any other thoughts?
No, well, you know, it's delivered what I expected it to deliver. You know, and like I said, I think quite a number of the new characters and weapons are fun to use, you know, that sets up pretty pleased. And it is nice to finally fight, you know, on new battlefields and against new bosses. That's the kind of extra content I was looking for. All the other kind of stuff is, you know, I feel like it's not really going to be substantively different enough to excite. There will be no DLC purchases for me, I don't think, you know, to extend
despite the fact that Link's Awakening is the best Zelda game. You're not going to get, what's her name in English? Marlin?
Yeah. Or Marin. Marin. Yeah. But it's, I like Link's Awakening very much, but yeah, I don't know whether Marin really, you know, it's kind of, especially because she's only really been depicted on, you know, in that game as a very simple bit of pixel art. It's kind of tough to,
and
to
really
associate it. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, in the manual, you could see an illustration. I think they based it on that, like the her
right
model.
They did.
But,
yeah. I do.
Yeah,
well,
I've only ever played it digitally, so I didn't have the manual.
So there's the and there's also the camera stuff. You played the DX one where you could
That's right. Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, cool. So, John.
Well, James, you know, what a difference a week makes, my friend.
It does.
I came here last week. And I talked about a game called Pokemon Go. At that time, it was new. It was new to everybody. Not everybody. Billions. It hadn't even been released everywhere yet.
It still hasn't.
Yeah, it still hasn't.
True.
Canada still isn't going anywhere.
Germany just got it today. Apparently.
It's billions of yen different in the course of a week.
Yes. So it seems this game has been out a long time, but that's just because it has been virtually omnipresent everywhere.
Yes, there has been this loud crashing sound that is Pokemon Go. And Pokemon Go related air quotes journalism. And Pokemon Go everywhere around you all the time because people are playing it all the time.
Yeah.
And Pokemon Go, when you look out the window and you see somebody running down the trails at work going, where the hell is he going? Then you realize he's going to defend his gym down the bottom of our trails when it's 102 degrees outside.
Yeah.
And he's got a fucking job at work.
It's hit full-blown phenomenon status at this point. It has taken off. On my Twitter, you have sports stars tweeting about, I was in center court some place, and I'm catching a Weedle. And you're like, why is LeBron James tweeting this? What's going on?
LeBron James catching a Weedle?
Yeah, it's just weird stuff like this. Like, everybody seems to have – it's kind of like the – I don't really know. I'm trying to think of what I could compare it to. And I guess you can't even really compare it to something like Angry Birds because more people are into it than that.
The one thing about this game that's super intelligent is the AR integration. It's not very involved.
Yep.
It's not even central to the game. You could turn that shit off. But it creates these moments of Pokemon in the real world, which is kind of something that people who played the game as a kid always kind of thought about.
Yeah.
Like even if you don't want to admit it, you always thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
And also it creates these images that themselves are very viral.
Yeah. It's very humorous. You can do humorous stuff with it. That becomes a kind of a game into itself.
I don't even necessarily know if that was entirely their intention. Like,
probably not.
There's no. We know for a fact this was not anticipated. Not to this degree, because they can't get their servers online. Like, today was the first evening where I could actually see what it was doing, after dinner, and it not just go, nah, not now, bro.
Yeah, yeah. That was especially bad on launch day. It was just this, you cannot connect to the server. You're done.
Yeah.
It's been interesting. There's been all kinds of crazy stuff happening.
So we actually haven't really talked about the game a whole lot mechanically because there's not a ton mechanically to talk about.
Yeah. I know more about the way the game works now than I did.
Absolutely.
Literally played it for an hour when I talked about it last week. So I hadn't even gone. I still haven't done anything at the gyms just because there isn't one near me, unfortunately. Just – kind of where I am.
I could talk about the gyms a little bit.
Oh, so you've been playing it, James.
I have poked around a little bit, yes.
All right.
What
team are you?
Whatever the yellow one is, I can't remember.
So what is that? That's Valor? I'm blue, so I'm Team Mystic. So,
I just tapped through those messages while they rambled on to me about the heart of the Pokemon. I'm like, look, we're all just Mike Vick in it here. Shut up and let me pick a team so I can get going. So mechanically, let's talk about the games. Basically, the game has to be running actively on the device, which is kind of a bummer. If it can be running in a passive mode where you're gathering steps and things can happen, that would be really nice. At least for me, it doesn't seem to work in passive mode, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, as you walk around, it's using the GPS on your phone to track your movements, and occasionally you'll come into hot zones where there's a Pokemon. And it does appear to be tied to a location because this afternoon I saw multiple people getting Pokemon at the exact same spot. The same Pokemon. So I guess it is geolocated. It's not just randomly happening.
Yeah, the Pokemon are also roughly tied to geographic regions. So you're bound to see more water Pokemon near water and so on.
So at work. So I basically have been limiting it to, I take an hour long, about 2 mile walk at lunch every day. It's kind of like my I need to be by myself and clear my head moment.
Mm-hmm. I can suppose.
And so that's and we have this trail at work that goes through the woods and it's about 2 miles long. And if especially in the dog days of summer, I don't see fucking anybody out there because
mm-hmm.
it's 94 degrees, so nobody's out there.
Yeah.
And normally it's just music, which is why I would like it to work in passive mode. But that's what's been happening. Because it's just like, okay, but it's in the woods. It knows I'm in the woods. So it's bugs, 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 bugs. Rattatas, birds, bugs, 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 bugs. All the time bugs.
Yeah.
But, like, so I actually, so as you walk around, you get Pokemon. The thing will vibrate. You tap on the Pokemon. So the primary view is an overhead map. They've basically taken Google Maps and styled it to kind of look cartoonish. It doesn't really match any Pokemon art style, which is kind of weird. But
it doesn't, yeah. I mean, they've done the bare minimum that they've had to get it up.
Yeah,
and
it looks
really.
It looks a little, but I mean, even the art in this game looks a little, except for the Pokemon themselves, like the character arts, look like Chinese knockoff Pokemon art. But
yeah,
it's weird. It's weird that they screwed up the art style, but regardless. As you walk around, you'll see things pop up on the map, either little blue dots that are stationary. They're always there on the map. You can see where they are. They are the Pokestops that we talked about last week. Or occasionally, you'll just sort of stumble across a Pokemon. And you tap on the Pokemon, and then the AR mode kicks in, or you can turn it off. And you'll see the Pokemon superimposed on the image from your rear camera. And they'll be moving around. And you have to flick Pokeballs at them and hope it catches them. And
yeah, so you swipe upwards. And the key to that is you can hold down, you can press on the ball, and a green circle appears over the Pokemon. And the green circle will shrink. It contracts. And when the green circle is the smallest, that's when you get the most XP for capturing the Pokemon. So pretty much you're throwing the Pokeball and bonking the Pokemon on the head. When the circle is the smallest.
I didn't know anything about that, the circle part.
Yeah, there's a bunch of little bunch of nuances like that. So
I was having trouble just aiming the stupid thing. Like, you have to throw it the certain height or power depending on how far away they are at the right angles. And
yeah, supposedly you can also, if you miss with a Pokeball, you can also tap on it and get it back. I haven't been able to 100% confirm that. I think it works, but it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to tell.
But so you catch your Pokemon, and if you get them, you get experience for you. You get, what's it called? Star power or whatever?
You get Stardust.
Stardust.
And you get candy for whatever Pokemon that you got.
Right. And I'll get back to that in a minute, because that candy and that Stardust is used for evolving and powering up your Pokemon. And we'll get to why that shit kind of sucks in a minute. But as you keep walking, you'll encounter these blue Pokestops. There you can engage. They're essentially geocached locations from Ingress.
Which is sometimes absolutely hilarious, because there are some that are very adult themed.
Oh yeah, I saw one today for a Brazilian waxing place.
Yeah, I mean, there's one. The funny one that I saw on Twitter was a place called Club Z in Seattle, which is a hardcore gay sex club.
Yes,
which you would never ever want in a kid's game.
The sign in the picture calls it like the world's only mirrored glory hole maze or something like that. It's like, what?
Yeah. So, but actually, what I just read is that that Niantic is actually putting up a page that will let you request the adding or removing of Pokestops and gyms.
Nice.
So they're kind of getting a handle on that,
right? And in fact, we were talking about this yesterday. They also announced that they are going to make partnered Pokestops,
yep,
where you can drive business to your location. And I want to talk about that for a minute, because Pokestops are really tangential to what's happening in this game. So I was going to go to a restaurant up there that I really like. I couldn't get in today, because as I walked, you know, about a mile down from where the parking area is to it, people were everywhere just staring down at their phones. And not like one or two people, like groups of people five or six deep everywhere. And then I got to the restaurant, and they have like a canopy out front, like one of those little pop-up tents that you can kind of sit under and have tables and stuff at like fairs and stuff, where they're giving out water. And they're copying an idea that Carly from the site picked up during PAX when Street Pass was new. And at PAX East, everybody was basically killing their 3DS just street passing all the time, because they had to clear all that shit. Where it was like, you leave. Her idea was, she sets up a table and you leave your 3DS with her, and she just clears all your street passes and charges your 3DS and basically charges you by the hour. So she just plugs you into the wall and you get money out of it. They're basically taking your phone and charging it and clearing all the Pokestops and catching Pokemon while you eat in their restaurant. And then you come out and you get your phone back. And that restaurant was as slammed as I have ever seen it.
Yeah.
Every seat in the bar, every single table, outside people were waiting in line. Like, I've never seen it that slammed on a Friday or a Saturday, let alone a Thursday. Like, it was an hour plus wait just to get to the bar. like people are already taking advantage of this, so this whole like sponsored thing is gonna cause problems, I think. People are gonna actually get all in. But on top of Pokestops, there are also gyms similarly based on geocache locations. In a gym, you have a strong Pokemon, take it there, and you fight the current gym leader, and it's basically just stat on stat fight. There's also some type involvement, I guess. And if you have a stronger Pokemon, you will take the gym, and then you will be able to essentially be the gym leader there for a while. I think you get experience for defending the gym and stuff. The challenge is, of course, the gyms have already been dominated by people who just play this game all the time.
Yeah, but you correct me if I'm wrong. You can actually, if you lose against the incumbent Pokemon at a gym, can you wear that Pokemon down over time?
I'm not sure.
Is it strictly one-on-one? Because Neil mentioned on Twitter, Neil Ronahan, esteemed director of the site, he mentioned that you can roll in with a team and wear the Pokemon down.
Yeah, I think it's three. I think you'd get stuck with three. Okay. I've only done it once, and I only had one Pokemon that was even not just straight garbage.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've seen Pokemon that are like, you know, 1,400 plus. Like, they're just insane.
Yeah, like I had one that's like 140, and that was the best I had. And his lead off was 900. And I'm like, I'm only doing this because I want to see it for the show. And then, oh, God, it's all gone wrong. It's all gone wrong so fast.
Yep.
But, I mean, really, that's pretty much the main riff of the game. You know, at the Pokestops, you get Pokeballs you can use. You may get some random items. And then to level up your Pokemon, you use the Stardust and the candies.
Yep.
The challenge is that it costs a lot of candies to evolve a Pokemon.
It does.
And that means you have to catch a shit ton of Pidgeys if you want to get the Pidgeotto. You have to just catch Pidgeys all day long.
Yeah, it's pretty much a bottom of 25 candies to even evolve even the most basic Pokemon.
Right. If it's a three form, and it's like a bug to like a Metapod, maybe it's 12. So that means you have to catch three of the damn things. Yep. But that doesn't, you actually have to boost their stats too, which is more candies. And then if you want to get to their final form, it's a ton of candies. It's like 50.
Yep.
And that takes a long time, like a very long time. And you have to find these ones to catch them. So some of the rarer ones, I don't know how in the world you're supposed to evolve them. And with the limited number of Pokemon you can carry in your bag without expanding it, that's kind of shit you have to manage. It's just, you know, I don't like the candy stuff.
Yeah.
Like, it just seems unnecessarily difficult. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're dealing with rare ones. And considering that's the only way to evolve them, like, yeah, like that seems unnecessary.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely geared towards, you know, getting people to buy the Poke Coins or whatever they are.
I was going to say, like, how much do you not like the candy stuff, James? Well, like, put a price on it.
Like, can you just straight up buy candies?
I don't know about candies, but I mean, you can, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff you can buy in the store. I will go on the record as saying I refuse to pour money into this game. I refuse. Steadfastly refuse.
You know, Pokemon Picross, I finally hit the end of the road without having not put a single penny into it. Mm-hmm.
That sounds impossible.
Well, I've not done everything, obviously, but, you know, there's a kind of a map that you go through, and I've hit the end of that map. I've caught Mewtwo. So, you know, I'm kind of vaguely proud that I managed to resist any attempt to lure me into microtransactions throughout that process.
So, let's speak more broadly about this game has caused investors to lose their mind.
I wish I had had the foresight to buy a Nintendo stock. I knew it would blow up this much.
So, like, first off, I'm talking about a video game at work, and that's weird. Like, that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But, like, we were talking about it, and every day we're like, all right, they've plateaued, right? And the next day we're like, God damn it, we could have made a ton of money.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of profit taking, but still, it's kind of like when they first announced mobile and the stock shot way up. But this one feels different than Miitomo, even though it's not part of the Nintendo deal with DNA. Mm-hmm. Like, it's totally separate from that. Mm-hmm. Because even though it's not part of that sort of mentality that they created about creating a unique experience for the mobile market that's different, it still feels like they created a unique something based on the mobile market that's different and still drives value to their brand.
Well, I think the difference with this one is
besides it being Pokemon.
Yeah, I just think there's a very low barrier to entry for it, and people know the Pokemon concept already, even if you haven't played a video game for 15 years. You know what Pokemon's all about. And people kind of get, you know, it's funny because I saw a tweet about Ingress and how fans of that game are kind of, you know, they're kind of salty that people are all
absolutely,
you know, Ingress has been around for a while now and is doing effectively the same thing, you know, and it's been repackaged and repurposed as Pokemon Go. But to me, Ingress didn't have the kind of hook that Pokemon Go has, because everybody likes Pokemon, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, there's very few people that hate it.
I think that's what's shocking, is just how deeply ingrained the Pokemon brand is.
It really is now. I mean, it's like Disney, like, Mickey Mouse level. It really is.
Like, I wonder what this is going to do for that brand. Like does this...
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's literally insane.
It's like people have been kind of crawling out of the woodwork, like texting me like, "Hey, are you playing that?" And I'm like, "Yeah, are you?" And they're like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Okay, why?" You don't, it's like mind blowing. Like, everybody's playing it.
People, I'm not kidding. People, like, I heard a story of somebody at work who literally missed a meeting where he was presenting because of a gym.
I can believe it, yeah. Well,
like,
and the thing is, too,
this is bizarre.
And people kind of see you can grasp the point of it really quickly. Like, hey, you walk around outside, which you're already doing, and you already have your phone on you all the time, so you just walk around and catch Pokemon, and people are like, okay, that sounds kind of fun. And then they see other people doing it, and they become part of a thing, you know? It's like, you know, and you can talk to people that you don't even know about catching Pokemon, and it's just this stupid thing that people can connect over.
So here's the question, and this is a more broad question. I'm going to open it up to everybody here. Ingress has said that they're going to – Niantic has said that they're basically going to be on two-week feature pushes. You know, cycles of just keeping engagement going by pushing stuff. So battling is coming. Trading is coming. I assume at some point second-generation Pokemon are going to come. So assuming they can – there will obviously be fall-off. Like, that's just the way this is.
Yep.
But assuming they can keep some degree of high-level engagement, and this has been – this has been at the front of the zeitgeist, the cultural zeitgeist all week. Does this kind of make sense? Like for what Iwata said when they talked about introducing mobile as the ability to drive their brand awareness, as a way to generate revenue, as a way to push the full experiences you can have on their systems. Because this is Miitomo, I didn't get that feeling at all. Miitomo just felt like, this is okay. Great, John's telling me about his cat.
Yeah, I got tired of that really quickly.
But this feels different. Like, I'm not sure that I'm going to stick with this beyond, you know, having had the conversation on the show this week. But, like, there's definitely a different tenor to the conversation about this. And not just, like, this mobile game is fun, but, like, shit, I love Pokemon. And, like, could this actually affect their bottom line in more ways than just the cut that they get from the Pokemon company?
Well, I mean, I think at the very least what they could start doing is on the splash screen that shows when it loads up the game, they could start, hey, let's put an ad on there for Pokemon Sun Moon on Nintendo 3DS. You know? It's almost like free advertising for the Pokemon games, for other Pokemon games that they're making.
Yeah, it's such a crazy product, because it's there's like we described the game, and we listed pretty much every single feature.
Yeah,
like there's not that much to it, and it requires you walk. And right now it's impossibly hot summer.
Yeah,
and like it was 8 p.m. and I was out walking, and it was still 94 degrees.
Yeah,
and I walked past literally 100 people playing that game.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, and that's the thing. I mean,
why?
Anybody can play it, and anybody can play it, and people can get it right away. And also, it just makes it's one of those games. I mean, I think back to to kind of other applications that have been kind of like this, or kind of services, like Foursquare. If you remember, if anybody here ever played Foursquare, that thing where you would go somewhere.
I am the mayor of this pizza place.
Exactly. It's exactly the same thing, except Foursquare, it was pointless. I mean, nobody cared about it, right? And
there's no real gamification beyond that.
Yeah. But not only that, because Ingress showed that if you just make that skeleton of a game, it's still only going to appeal to a niche audience.
Right.
But this is like finally like the like when I think about it, like why did I mean Ingress worked, but it has a very core audience. But why did this game blow up? And it's because of Pokemon.
Right.
It kind of reminds me of this Mad TV skit, I'm sorry, where it was basically Michael Jackson like doing like a self-help video, how to become like an international kind of celebrity. And the first step was like be incredibly famous, and then second, like be weird. Like I feel like the first step is kind of, well, you know, not everyone can do that, Michael Jackson. So... You know, like, okay, like, Pokemon, but, like, are you telling me that anyone could do this if they just have, like, this 2-decade-old kind of multimedia, you know, mega million selling franchise? Is that what we're saying?
I mean, with mobile, it seems to I know very little about mobile. I don't play mobile games. I've been pretty thoroughly insulated from this whole madness, apart, especially because it hasn't even come out over here until today. You know, it's saliency is the tricky part. How do you achieve saliency when everything's free to play? And, you know, how do you stand out and how do you draw people in? The two things here is the power of Pokemon as a brand, and then the nostalgic appeal and the fact that you've got a generation or even generations to some extent of people out there that, you know, have this kind of shared knowledge of it. And then, you know, you've got this the fact of like throwing people together by drawing them to these common locations. You know, it sort of, to continue the sort of saliency analogy, that's when crystals start forming, you know, and then it just kind of goes from there, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, also, too, at this point, the fact that Pokemon is locked to Nintendo hardware is restricting its appeal. I mean, not everybody wants to buy a Nintendo 3DS. Not everybody even knows what a Nintendo 3DS is at this point. And the same thing with Wii U. I mean, Nintendo's hardware has not been hitting home runs. So, but what is hitting a home run is Android and iOS. So, There's a lot of people out there that still love Pokemon and would still play Pokemon, but hey, they haven't given a crap about Nintendo hardware for a long time. But now it's on hardware that they actually own and they have with them all the time. So,
but I would say the key here is that this doesn't devalue the core gameplay mechanics of the other game, because it actually doesn't copy very many of them at all.
No.
It bears very little in resemblance with what core Pokemon is.
Yeah, it's like Pokemon Light.
It's not even that. It feels structurally very different. I mean, you don't fight anything right now except for the gym leaders.
Yeah.
Like, the core progression mechanic of fight, level up, fight, level up, fight, level up isn't there at all. Mm-hmm. So...
Well, that's probably a good thing given how stuck in a rut Pokemon has been.
Mm-hmm. Well, like that's like the whole reason to collect these Pokemon is to enhance your fighting skill. And in this game, it's like, no, that's not even here. Don't even worry about that part. That part is totally tangential unless you want to play with the gyms. Like, there is this sort of sense of, like, they're able to create something that I'm reasonably confident they will see at least some ancillary sales of the next Pokemon game as a result of this thing.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't...
But just to say, it might remind some people of you know, how much they enjoyed those games, you know, and maybe they'll try, you know, think about dipping back in to see what has or hasn't changed in the mainline games. But it also shows, you know, what was important about the popularity of Pokemon at the beginning and over time is more than just, you know, the bones of the games. It is the characters, and obviously that went into the anime and all that kind of stuff. Because as you said, I mean, the appeal of this is more about the sort of the notion of going around catching Pokemon rather than the nuts and bolts of how you actually did that when you played the game in the back on Game Boy or GBA or whatever generation you got in on.
And the other thing it's been good for, and we'll talk a little about this in the next segment, is that it's been very good for their consciousness, the awareness. Like, there is a certain energy around Nintendo as a company right now.
Yep.
That a month and a half ago they didn't have.
No.
And we'll touch on it we have an email that deals with it fairly specifically in the next segment. But it's like, this is good for them. And this makes the NX timing actually pretty good. Because if they can keep some degree of hype around them for the next couple months, which they should be able to, and they go actually really do a good job with their announcement next, like, that's really good for their position as a company people are thinking about.
Yep. And this game could not have come at a better time in the middle of the summer when there's really not a whole lot of huge games coming out.
Right.
Pokemon Go is going to... Kids are outside.
They're outside, not school.
I mean, Pokemon Go is going to own this summer. You're not going to be able to avoid it. So get used to people walking into your backyard, folks, because...
And they've got two more mobile games coming out this year.
Yep.
Animal Crossing.
I'll be knocking on your door soon, Fire Emblem. Because, I got to catch a Zubat.
I really need to see what the Fire Emblem mobile game is.
Hey, buddy. For you, the Tub Time Pokestop is open.
Oh, God.
Open for business.
I will say that even though they weren't as involved in this as they were in the other games, it seems like the ethos they're going for was applied here. And so I'm excited to see, how they're going to translate Animal Crossing and Fire Emblem to mobile.
Yeah.
And if those games are even fractionally as successful, then I think they've done two things. One, they've created awareness around their brand. They've created an energy. And two, they've proven that they can go into mobile and appease the investors without devaluing the really more advanced gameplay experience that you would want to have on a dedicated system.
Yeah. I mean, Animal Crossing should be pretty easy.
Yeah, the one thing I'll say about Animal Crossing, I think it's suited to mobile, but I think you will have to have an experience that's more substantively similar to its parent game than you've got here, because I don't think the characters are as powerful, certainly in the West. You only have to look at the nosediving prices of those amiibo to realize that, it's not a character.
And that might be okay.
That's not necessarily what people love about Animal Crossing.
And it might be okay if that one just does well in Japan, it doesn't do as well in the West.
Like, exactly. Nintendo may look at it that way too.
But still, this, to me, more than Miitomo, this has proven out the theory that they can be successful in mobile and successful in dedicated separately together. And I think they believe that too, because just this week we heard they're hiring more dedicated mobile developers for their Kyoto and Tokyo studios.
Yep.
Which means they're not talking about spinning down their resources and making other stuff. They're talking about growing.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about growing, you're a company with some fucking swagger.
And that's not something they've really been talking about much over the past several years.
I think we're gonna have to wrap up this segment. But we'll be back after the break with your listener mail.
The Tub Time Pokestop is never too far away.
It's now playing. A sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a feature, Iwata Asks in Commemoration, by Matt Walker. Out of the shadows comes Matt Walker. That may not be his real name. Our man in Japan with a special treat on the first anniversary of the passing of the revered Satoru Iwata. Enjoy a series of previously untranslated Japanese interviews with Iwata, this time regarding Animal Crossing. I doubt it ever mentions the plan for Animal Crossing Happy House Arrest, or that they're going to have a hard time supplying paper fucking cards to Japanese stores.
You're still bitter, aren't you, James?
Thanks, Amiibo. Thank you, Amiibo. We also have a contest, the Summer of Amiibo, week 4. If you've missed the first 3 weeks of this contest, it's time to get on board. This week we have a caption contest involving a picture of Greninja. Join the revolution.
It's like leaving breadcrumbs for an animal most of the time.
I wish I had planned that.
Yep.
But I don't read ahead.
Yep.
I want this to all be legit, so...
Yep.
We can't escape Amiibo.
All right, and we have a review of Monster Hunter Generations for 3DS by Alex Gulafi. Alex takes the newest Monhan title for a spin and compares it to Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate. If you have the previous game, will you want this one? How are the Hunter arts and Prowler class? Can you finally hunt boxes? That's what I want to know. All is revealed in his review.
I do every day.
I know. And we have an interview, a severed interview with Graham Smith, not the interview itself, the game severed.
There you go.
With TYP, Aaron, and Jared. Jared and TYP talked to Graham about his new game, Severed, at the Indie Mix event from E3 2016. Find out what his inspirations are and why the game looks how it does and how that look affects its gameplay.
You can affect our gameplay through our look on our website, CentenderWorldReport.com. I didn't really think up an intro for the second part of the show either, so I guess we're going to continue John's intervention. Last time we talked about a lot of stuff that wasn't John's intervention, so I figured we'll have an intervention about some description here, because we talked about the zeitgeist that Pokemon Go has invaded, and whenever something really rises to the top of the internet, you can bet for sure that producers and site directors are going to make sure their writers write every goddamn article they can about it. So if you follow me on Twitter, or if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know I'll rail against so-called think pieces, where it feels like the author was like, look how smart I am, I've got this great take on this thing that you didn't think of, and most of the time they're idiotic. I'll give you a fantastic example where a certain outlet that will soon to be owned by Mr. Hulk Hogan may have implied that if you enjoy, hey, people enjoying Pokemon Go, think about people in wheelchairs who can't enjoy Pokemon Go as much. It's like, fuck you too. I didn't see you during the DDR craze telling me that this wasn't going to work out, so fuck off. A lot of times they can either fall into the hot takes category, or they can fall into what would best be described as concern trolling. Trying to come up with a problem that doesn't really exist, or trying to, you know, look how profound I am thinking about it. And everyone has gotten into it. And if you've seen my Twitter, I've just been pasting just screenshots from Google News where you'll get like six of them in a row. And they're all awful. And they're all either terrible, like they'll describe how Pokemon Go has changed the face of virtual reality, which is impressive because it's not virtual reality, and also it hasn't changed anything. You could, in fact, there's in fact a 3DS app that does exactly what this game does with AR. It's been out for like 5 years. So actually it didn't do anything, but that's fine. And I figured we need to get in on this. This is easy ad money, because I'm going to be as craven and as completely lacking in scruples as all of our journalistic peers. So, gentlemen, give me your article pitch. We've got to get on the Pokemon Go gravy train.
Well, I think that Pokemon Go tells us about, you know, the society that we live in 2016. I'm sorry to come back to the same meme that I mentioned 2 weeks ago, but Pokemon Go, you know, like this augmented reality game means that we've got these critters all around us, and Pokemon Go being so popular, like it's entirely conceivable that Barack Obama has met Geodude and considers him his friend and to be strong and, you know. So what I'm saying, I guess, is that, you know how, you know, people say whenever, like, the news become even more crazy than the Onion headlines, like, well, satire is dead, you know, like, reality is just way worse. Well, I would say that we live in a reality where the meme and fan fiction are dead, and reality has overtaken fan fiction. So
I'm gonna put it into you for good words. Nintendo steals story of Pokemon in the real world fan fiction. Author outraged. Done.
Oh, okay, is that the format that is supposed to take?
There's your headline. I'm giving you your headline. If I am your news producer, I'm giving you the headline for your article.
Okay. Because I'm just saying,
you gotta make it punchy.
I see. I like to look at like the, you know, what Pokemon Go says about society, and what it tells me is that these new technologies like, you know, like robotics, 3D printing, holograms, and everything means that Kirk and Spock will find each other. And you know, like everything that you've ever written or read on the internet that was, you know, terrible and beautiful and everything, you know, like that, it's going to happen.
Oh, I'm looking forward to my Daisy and Peach fanfiction. So, does anyone else have any before I drop? I dropped some.
I said, I've been insulated from this, so I'm not, in the zeitgeist to deliver. And after Obama palling around with Gia Duda, I mean, I've got nothing.
All right. Pokemon gets kids outside, but proves that zoos are immoral. Because now you don't need to see animals in cages where they don't belong. They belong in the jungle, and you can see the animals in the real world. And as every day that tiger lives in that cage is a sin. It should be in the jungle where it belongs, eating all of its fantastic vegetarian dietary options. And they can experience these animals on their phone and not in cages. This is brought to you by PETA, who will also make an app themselves where you murder these Pokemon. But that's okay. It's okay, because we're going to post a press release full sail and I don't have to write anything, and I can fire all you as writers and take that money myself. Yeah! Journalism in the year 2016.
You must be on YouTube.
To be fair, I can literally be describing any online journalism in the year 2016. Yeah, you're all fired. I'm printing press releases and I'm taking all the money. So, I've actually shot some of my better options of, like, Pokemon Go is responsible for kids getting fit, for promoting health, followed by Pokemon Go promoting Zika. I like the idea of those two headlines being next to each other. But I had one, I swear, I was thinking about this, and I had one about, like, Pokemon Go in Brazil for the Rio Olympics, and then a news story came out that the mayor of Rio was campaigning that they be one of the countries added, and I'm like, God damn it.
See, that goes to Guillaume's point again, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is, the world is now too surreal. Shouldn't you be, like, fixing all of the problems your city has rather than campaigning for Pokemon Go right now? Or the crime in the favelas, or the grinding poverty, or the breakdown of, like, all of the infrastructure. But it's okay.
Or 7-1.
Or, like, the news stories that have come out, like, woman finds body looking for Pokemon. I'm just trying to get to, like, driver's ed instructor crashes car while teaching class / catching Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really, we just want to get there. And that's just more like Onion stories. I really wanted to get to the concern trolling. So something along the lines of Pokemon is responsible. Well, Pokemon Go will create a spread of Zika is really the kind of just unfounded science plus basic association to get your Google score up.
Yeah, the old Poke conspiracy theories, I think, will be running wild. Because this is obviously a mass experiment.
I actually legitimately thought of doing this segment and just actually having Google News open and just reading the most insane ones, and then at the end revealing, I didn't make any of these up, they're all real! But right now, it's not cooperating and giving me real bullshit. It's giving me just kind of bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Although Pokemon Go is now exempted from the T-Mobile data caps, so that's a thing. Anyway.
Wow.
Emails. We do emails. We talk about email on the show, and we read your emails when you send them to us. Please send them to us. RFN@NintendoWorldReport.com. You can send us your Pokemon clickbait articles. Guillaume, I'm going to have you read Tripon's email.
Tripon writes, so what do you think of Nintendo's recent push to embrace RPGs? From Xenoblade Chronicles X, Tokyo Mirage Sessions, Fire Emblem Fates, and even the upcoming Zelda Breath of the Wild, taking RPG elements such as crafting, weapon selection, and hit points, Nintendo seems to have a very focused emphasis on RPGs that seem to be part of their core development. Yeah, and Tripon doesn't mention all the RPGs that Nintendo is publishing, but...
the summer of RPGs.
That's one thing, though. You know, like Bravely Default came out recently, but that's a Square game that Nintendo's publishing...
and it came out in Japan not so recently.
Right. Tokyo Mirage Sessions is developed by Atlus. Fire Emblem, of course, Intelligent Systems, and Xenoblade. So those two are in-house. I think RPGs are Nintendo's recent push on the Wii U and 3DS, because the Wii U and 3DS are several years into their lives, and that's when RPGs happen.
The cyclical component, as we've talked about before with this, where we did the end-of-life cycle kind of feature. This is generally what happens with platforms, and I mean, some of it is purely just how long they take to come to fruition, especially when you're dealing with the Western markets where you've got a bit of localization delay on the end of it. I mean, how long ago... It was early in the Wii U's life that we heard about Xenoblade Chronicles X and indeed Shin Megami Tensei Cross Fire Emblem, but they just take a very long time to make, and you know, ultimately then after some localizations, well, to get to us. And here we are. So it feels like this big kind of logjam at the end. Of course, we look at Wii, you know, there were other factors involved with that, perhaps in terms of earlier in its life, maybe people just didn't think that was the kind of console where, you know, people would play that kind of experience. But still, whatever the reasons, we saw Xenoblade and The Last Story at the end. You know, that is generally what happened. So I don't know whether I would characterize it as a... something of an embrace in general. I think it is a kind of a life cycle kind of thing. Although I suppose the way Zelda's going is kind of interesting in terms of it's just, you know, what that's incorporating. Again, Zelda's another type of game that always, you know, seems to take a very long time. You know, obviously we had Wind Waker was relatively early in the GameCube's life cycle, which famously, of course, seemed rather rushed. But, you know, since then, you know, Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword and now Breath of the Wild, they're all right towards the end, even though it's not a traditional RPG. It's another one of those kinds of games that, you know, has a lot of world building and very complex. It takes a long time to kind of see it come to fruition. And so I suppose in that sense, it's only natural that it would, you know, borrow some things that are popular in similar kinds of experiences that, you know, in the Japanese market especially.
And you compare that with the launch games for the Wii U, and, you know, New Super Mario is not something that takes long to make.
But,
and Nintendo Land sure didn't look like it took too long to make.
I will say that conversely on that, Mario Maker would have taken a lot longer to make. Because ultimately you had to test every goddamn thing to make sure it didn't break when you stacked it with every other thing. But I do think there is a certain amount of Nintendo internally producing more RPGs or contracting for more RPGs. Because you know, that's kind of been the one area where their brand, I mean, they had their Paper Mario series and their Mario and Luigi series, but internally they didn't do a ton of RPG work. You know, they had Fire Emblem, but they've really been pushing Fire Emblem a lot harder now. It was always kind of, you know, not on the periphery, but something that they didn't drive on as hard as, say, other parties and let other companies fill out that backlog. And I wonder,
you know, famously, there's a history of Nintendo at the very highest levels not being that warm towards the genre. Obviously, there were sort of unkind comments that Yamauchi once made during a very sort of sour grapes phase after, you know, that Nintendo was on the wrong end of things with the N64 and the PS1, and it didn't really have very many RPGs at all. But Miyamoto also is kind of said to be not that keen on the convention of the RPG genre. So yeah, in that sense, you know, they haven't always had the most sort of powerful champions for those games within the company. But I guess, you know, especially with how Japan centric their business has been recently, I mean, obviously it always is, but with the Wii U really struggling and leaving the 3DS as their sort of one, you know, somewhat successful platform, and then of course how dominated by Japan that is in terms of who actually makes games for it, it's only natural that, you know, they're going to warm up to it a bit more even than they have in past cycles, because that is what their third-party partners are churning out. And then it's like, well, that creates a sort of expectation about, you know, the sort of player base that's still actively using a 3DS, and therefore, you know, something like what they're doing with Gretzo, the Ever Oasis, is it? That's another one they've sort of commissioned, as it were, an action RPG, you know, because the games, both their own and from other developers, it's just that shown those are the players that are still active on 3DS at this point.
And not just like still active at this point. Like I know it's anecdotal, but here in Montreal, there's a few universities, and that when I street pass in the subway, like that's I get a surprising number of street passes for Atlas games, for you know Bravely Default, for Fire Emblem. That those are the games that I see most often. It's not like Frozen, you know. Either little kids don't street pass, or they're not take. Well, they also don't take the subway, I guess. But anyway, like I'm just saying, like there's a surprising number of people who throughout the 3DS's life have been consuming these games, like the Shin Megami Tensei's and the Etrian Odyssey. Etrian Odyssey 4 was like the biggest one of the series, like the best selling one.
And Fire Emblem
and
as well.
Like
you know,
the
I
DS
mean,
was a slouch, you know, in terms of RPGs.
No, exactly. I mean, it's a good point because Fire Emblem, you know, James talked about pushing. You know, I mean, to some extent, that started off as a kind of a Hail Mary type of deal with Awakening in terms of they weren't sure, you know, on its current trajectory as it had been on DS, which had been a RPG powerhouse in most respects. But, you know, for Fire Emblem, it wasn't necessarily, for whatever reason, the most fertile ground. And then, you know, yeah, that Hail Mary worked. You know, evidently it was thrown by Aaron Rodgers because it was complete. And, you know, then, and then, you know, they can, if he'd be bold enough to sort of push something like Fates, you know, late in the Sisters life where you've got these kind of three campaigns in the same world and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, it's funny in a way, even though, you know, 3DS in most respects is only a fraction as successful as the DS, for RPGs it's arguably been, you know, a sort of a step up, which is quite interesting. And I think, you know,
or at least
that,
lateral.
That probably has kind of helped Nintendo warm to it, and you know they've been involved with stuff like Monster Hunter as well, which isn't, you know, sort of classic JRPG, but again it's kind of a long form experience that seems to, you know, kind of appeal to some of the same people, and that's gained more traction as well, hasn't it? You know, it's definitely you know, through all its various incarnations, I think the 3DS is where it's found the biggest foothold in the West.
Absolutely. And they've been active in making that happen. And you can look at definitely some of the ideas from that game have made their way into Breath of the Wild, which we actually said the name correctly twice so far in this episode, which is terrifying.
Can we make it through a whole episode without misnaming it?
Nope. Probably not. But I think the other thing is we talk about on our console space where they've been actively making these RPGs, but it goes back to who they're working with now. So Atlas is about as tight a partner as Nintendo can have right now.
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, to the point where it was kind of surprising that they weren't the ones who walked away with them when the sale happened. So it's not super shocking that they went and partnered with them to make an RPG, because they knew Persona 5, well, they assumed Persona 5 would be out by now, I would assume. Because everyone else did. But they probably assumed they weren't going to get it, and so they figured we'll make something of our own. I don't know if there was that causality, but they knew that there was a market for that, and they said, well, we need one for our system. And so they got one. And, I mean, Atlas is a close partner, so it's not surprising they got access to the Nintendo character vault to do it. You look at the fact they bought Monolith Soft. Like, this is what they make, with the exception of one foray into a fairly
90s
ill-conceived
action pictures.
Yeah,
one
terrorism,
fantastic foray.
Terrorism
add.
Simulator. You know, that's what they do. They make these big, bold, weirdly paced, oddly story-driven RPGs, and that's what they've been for Nintendo. They've been a tech house. They've also made some Super Robot Wars games, but. Like, Nintendo has beefed up their arms that make this stuff. They have intelligence systems around. They've been empowered to make stuff. You know, the second-party companies that make the Mario and Luigi games, I'm blanking on what they're called.
FO Dream?
Yeah. Like, Nintendo brought them in the GBA era. Like, they've been building up the resources either internally or in their closely aligned companies to make this happen. And I think this was just the generation where all of those players were fully equipped to go out and do. And Nintendo had worked with them enough that they were willing to just let them churn their products out and let the games happen. And, you know, this is part of the, you know, moving towards more involved development, where bigger projects, because of the necessity of art assets, where also just filling in your backlog, having teams that can produce products on a schedule. And the more teams you have, either internally or as close partners, the more that schedule fills out. And it just happens that they brought in a bunch of people who specialize in these games. And it certainly has shown, you know, it's come to fruition now where you're seeing, you know, if you include Bowser's Inside Story, we've seen three of those games in 6-7 years. We've seen, you know, a Paper Mario game. We're going to have another Paper Mario game soon. Like, just those games, the Mario RPGs, using, you know, the secondary resource teams, the external teams, fill out the schedule a lot on their own.
But so I do think there is some element of poor planning from Nintendo, though, in terms of what's come out on the Virtual Console. Because I've said this before, but I really wish that they would frontline the RPGs under VC services, because at the beginning of a platform's life is when you don't have the RPGs. So why not try to focus, not try to bring the old RPGs first, you know, to fill that gap, and then give, you know, the glut of RPGs that you know are coming toward like 4 or 5 years into a system's life, 3-4 years into a system's life, some room to breathe, you know? Because like, okay, just like what, 3 weeks ago, Nintendo finally released Paper Mario RPG on the Virtual Console. What am I saying? Nintendo finally released a Super Mario RPG on the Virtual Console. And it's like, well, okay, but you just released, you know, Tokyo Mirage Sessions.
Yes.
And while there might not be a big overlap, there's going to be some overlap, you know. And also, we got a Mario & Luigi game just, 7 months ago. And we're getting a Paper Mario game in 4 months. So, like, couldn't you have maybe timed this a little bit better? They should really, at this point, Nintendo is kind of knows what they're doing with you know, like they know the console space. They should know what happens. They should be able to plan for this stuff. And it just seems like they don't.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like, I mean, from all accounts, they were kind of caught flat-footed by the dismal failure of the Wii U. I mean, you know, recently they said that they expected the Wii U to sell 100 million. And it's like, wow.
Well, that was a number thrown around internally, not necessarily what the full projection was.
Somebody in charge thought that.
Yes. But so, there were also people in charge who apparently were like, this isn't going to go well. So,
yeah.
So, but, I do think what you'll see on the next one, to Guillaume's point, though, is better planning of stuff that they can plan with respect to digital releases of content that already exists.
Because, I mean, well, yeah, content that already exists, but also maybe some projects that have been pushed back and are going to show up on the NX early. Like, I'm hoping that sometimes, you know, you do get an early RPG, Golden Sun on the GBA. Like, of course, like, not the same technical stuff to overcome. Like, it was much more simplistic than what we get today. But apparently it can be done, right? Like, if it's done far enough in advance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think we've said pretty much all we can on this one, and we've actually gone into a bit more topic. So move on to the next email.
Do you want me to read?
John, you have the next email.
All right. Jonathan Weinhold writes, okay, team, what are the odds that Nintendo will do some work on the ports? This is regarding, let me start this over again because I'll read the title. He doesn't actually. Jonathan Weinhold writes, regarding the Mini NES, what are the odds that Nintendo will do some work on the ports shipping in this thing? I don't need another copy of Mario 3, but the sprites on something like Super Mario Maker look so great that if I can get some real high-def versions of all these games, then I can easily rationalize the price, which is $60, $10 for an NES controller. Nintendo hasn't done as much work on their VC ports as they could have, or should have, if you ask me, but is there a reason to believe this time around?
So, before we read into this too much, we got an email from Sam who was postulating, and I wanted to point out some stuff here. He was postulating at one point that he was wondering if the NX, being a family of systems, was actually going to pull the Xbox One / PS1 / reboots of like Killer Instinct, Mortal Kombat, Devil May Cry, and God of War, all dropping their sequel numbers and just going back to the original name, and wondering if this would be a portable and console that would be essentially the Nintendo Entertainment System all over again. And then with the release of this new rebranded NES Classic Edition with, quote, 30 pre-installed games. And on the box, NES yes. Classic Edition. I thought, are they actually doing this? Nah, Nintendo wouldn't do this. And as awesome as it would be, they don't want to confuse gamers with their gaming with their naming conventions. And then I remembered the new 3DS. So it is theory of, is this a lead up to the next Nintendo systems being simply referred to as the Nintendo Entertainment System console and portable? No. Is the answer to that question?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you have to realize why the NES was called that in the first place. It was because they were trying to distance themselves from video games.
Right, and in fact, in Japan, it had a whole different name, and it would be very difficult for them to brand market across regions with different names now. That was actually fairly common at that era. Even in Western markets, they would have different names.
Yeah.
But I now...
In 1985, video games, you know, that you had the 83 video game crash and all that stuff, they were kind of looked at as poison in the market. So right. Nintendo was like, no, we're not about video games. We're not about the Atari 2600 and all of the shovelware that came out for that. We're about
entertainment system. Right. Yeah. And in fact...
Yeah, it was a lot of different prongs to the strategy. There was kind of positioning it as a toy with Rob and the Zapper. There was positioning it as like something more like a VHS type of system, you know, which is why it had the kind of the big boxes and the front loading kind of cartridges, unlike, you know, what the Famicom had in Japan, all that right. kind of stuff. But I don't know, it's not something I would totally rule out of hand, to be honest. I think other people in the past have postulated whether it would actually be called the new NES to talk about the,
oh,
you
Jesus.
Know, they are so fond of the new priest.
It's the newness. Can that it, could be the
can
slogan.
It be, can it be everybody's new NES?
Yeah, in Europe, possibly, is a more literal translation, I don't know. But, you know, I wouldn't put it absolutely past it. But the timing's kind of interesting because in some ways you might have thought this might be, you know, more suitable to come out last year on the 30th anniversary of the launch in the States.
So let's go over quick what it is if you're listening to the show and don't follow Nintendo news. So it is, if you remember those, like, I guess it was like 2006-ish, where Jack Specific got the rights to make these Atari, like, 30-in-1 joysticks you just hook up directly to the ports of your TV, and you could play a bunch of emulated, like, old Atari games. And we had this weird explosion of, like, direct-to-TV plug-in video games, where it was basically just, like, 30-in-1, 15-in-1, 20-in-1. And this is essentially the NES version of it. But unlike a lot of these, this one's actually made internally. It's not, you know, licensed out to somebody. It's got 30 NES games, some of which are not Nintendo-published.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to have control ports. So it's actually going to be controllers that are using the same control port as the back of the Wii remotes. And it looks like an NES... It looks just like an NES, but yeah. smaller, obviously. And it's HDMI, which makes it better than all of those old Jack-specific ones right off the bat, because they were all like RCA. So, I mean, ultimately, it's a nostalgia bomb. It's an expensive nostalgia bomb. But, like, I was talking about this swagger Nintendo has coming out of E3 with Breath of the Wild, coming out of Pokemon Go, where, like, look at the power our brands have. This thing is the ultimate statement of look at the power our brands have.
Well, I'm just glad that they're actually tapping into retro, to their retro everything in cool ways, right? Like, this is the kind of stuff where, I mean, I see this and I'm just like, I salivate over this thing, right?
Because these games are all on the virtual console right now. Every last
absolutely.
One of them
this is.
Well,
this is, I need this
yeah,
thing,
well, although,
like,
at least they have
head.
Been. That, at least they have been on the virtual console at some point. Like, I don't think Final Fantasy, which is one of them, is on the Wii U virtual console, is it?
I don't think,
like,
it is. It's on
an
odd,
but
virtual
it, but
console.
It had, but it was on, yeah, the Wii one. And I guess that's one interesting point, actually, in terms of the question about the quality of the ports, as it was put in the question, you know, the emulation, perhaps. You know, in some ways, when you're talking about NES, you'd rather it be like the Wii emulation than Wii U, for whatever reason.
Right.
That generally seems to be, you know, the more authentic. So whether it is essentially just, you know, like, you know, it's pared down Wii running those emulated games just as they were on the virtual console. I don't know, although we do know it's got... think even in the press release, it mentioned actual multiple restore points, which would actually be better than what we had, because it just had suspend points. Yeah, just suspend the game and come out and then come back where you were.
So, I mean, in the idea of them adding content or doing work on these games, I don't know. Like, I think you're probably looking at what would probably be a good... I would imagine it would be a good emulation. This is a product that is totally driven as an emulator. This isn't Virtual Console where it's a feature of a larger system. This is all this system will do. And it's not going to have download games. Like, these are the games for this system.
No, as far as it looks like, yeah, no internet connectivity and no ability to connect to external storage.
Right. So this is what this game has in it. So I would hope these games are tested and like crazy tested. And it is as good as they can make it, because they know what these games are. They know what the hardware they're going to run on. These should be really good.
Yep.
And this seems like it is not for us, but it is totally for us. Hold on. It is for the same people who are super excited about Pokemon Go. People who have this affinity for the brand, but don't own a Wii U right now. Don't own a 3DS right now. It is about re-engagement. It is a product targeting an audience that isn't around right now, but may have been around just as recently as 5 years ago. And, you know, saying like, look at this is the power of our brand. We can put this thing out and charge a boatload of money for it, and you will pay for it. And people will. I think this thing will probably sell pretty well for them.
I think it will too.
And there's like a good energy around them right now because of stuff like this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all about packaging. It just looks really cool.
It does.
It's awesome. I think it's so neat.
They nailed the website. Like, if you look at the website, it looks like the old ad. Oh, you should. It looks like the old advertising literature for the NES. So, like, Nintendo.com right now, it's like one of the most prominently featured parts of their website. And, like, it's cool. Like, it's just a cool thing to have. Like, I have no interest in buying this, but like, undeniably, it's a neat piece of kit that they've made.
Yeah. I love it. I just love it.
The one thing I'd say for me, we have a question come in about, like, your gaming rig, you know, your sort of setups and stuff. HDMIs are at a premium. This is not worthy of taking up an HDMI slot.
Yeah, I've already had to get a switcher.
You'd have to be switching it out and stuff, but I mean, seriously, I can't really see myself getting it because, you know, I've got a lot of the games that I want already, you know, from the thought. It's a good selection, I think, because it's not, you might have thought it'd be more black box game sort of dominated, especially, you know, if it had come out last year on the sort of 30th anniversary of the launch in the States and everything, you know, that might have been the temptation, but this has got, you know, pretty late games, stuff like Star Tropics and Kirby's Adventure, but also the third party touchstones like Castlevania 1 and 2, you know, Final Fantasy we mentioned, Super C, you know,
Tecmo Bowl, John. It's got Tecmo Bowl.
Yep.
Yeah, it's got Tecmo Bowl. Yeah, a lot of different sort of things that were really associated with the NES, you know, whether they were Nintendo or not, like Mega Man 2, for instance. I think that's a nice job. The biggest thing that comes to me out of this is that NES classic controller, essentially. I've already got the Super Nintendo one that they did as part of Club Nintendo over here. So it just feels right to have an NES one to go with it, especially as I don't have any physical NES controllers left from the old days because our system broke down and we just flogged everything else.
And they're going to be selling those things for $10 a pop, which is not bad. Especially,
yeah.
I won't want to use it because I remember how much that controller hurt to hold after.
Yeah, and it literally has less functionality than your typical classic controller. But, you know, that's where the whole packaging point is very, very pertinent.
What's interesting to me is at the bottom of the NES Classics page, and I sent it to you guys, there's a logo of just the NES controller stylized with the stylized word Classics.
Yep.
Which doesn't match anything anywhere on the branding of this device. It's called the Classic Edition, not Classics. It's not using the NES font. It's not using the stylized controller they've got down there anywhere else, which leads me to believe that this is part of a thing.
Yeah, it's a new line.
Yeah.
And I love it.
But I'm kind of wondering, though, if we're going to see, like, the SNES Classic Edition or if we're going to see an NES 2.
Yeah.
Because, like, with, like, a different selection of games, well, I hope, because getting the same games would be stupid. Right. But also, like, maybe, like, they're working on some sort of, like, Zapper adapter, like, we, like, in the sequel, we would get Duck Hunt and stuff like that.
Also, the branding's on the top of the box, my mistake, but it does look, it does stand out very differently.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it would be cool. I mean,
sure.
I don't think that any of us are likely to, well, John might buy it.
I would have pre-ordered it by now if I could. I don't know if I
have it as a paperweight.
I want this thing bad.
I just, it's outside of, impulse purchase for me. And, I kind of, like, everyone that I know that would be interested in this is, tech savvy enough to have downloaded ROMs on their Wiis. Well,
but
the ROMs, I mean,
but there's an undeniable, like, there was a, like, I saw the press release for this last night before I went to bed, because I think for once, the Australian press releases weren't 27 hours behind. And
I'm not saying it won't sell.
No,
it will sell.
I know. I was actually surprised by, like, when I woke up this morning, the kind of energy around it. Like, yeah, this looks cool. I'm really excited about this. And, like, I would have never guessed. Because if you go back to even recently, like 2010, all those, you know, plug-in directly consoles from Jack Specific were basically sitting in bargain bins. Like, 3 cents and you can have this Darth Vader head that's also a controller.
Yeah, and I mean, like, Sega have done one already, you know, for Mega Drive, haven't they?
Now it actually took cartridges. Like, you could
That had pre-installed games, but you could put actual games in it, which, you know, obviously is something that this does not have. So, you know, the idea, like you said, is really quite old. It's kind of weird that if they... You know, it go back to what we said about TurboGrafx games of Virtual Console. It's like, why now? Why, in some ways, you know, they didn't do it with the anniversary. But I suppose the only thing you could say is that they are a bit light on product for this holiday season, apart from Pokemon. You know, I suppose it is something they can sell in the absence of NX coming out this year and the absence of any kind of seemingly big push on Wii U and all that. They've kind of got space there, you know, in their kind of retail channels and all that kind of stuff to push something like this, and that probably will be a pretty safe bet for them to bring home, you know, a significant chunk of money, if nothing like sensational.
But this is... There's more to it here, though, because this is a statement of this feels like a pivot, because they're essentially saying these things have value separate from the system that we currently sell them to you on. And previously, they have been very resistant to having NES games appear on these kinds of plug-and-play consoles. And I wonder if it's a larger initiative to say, like, we're going to give you lots of ways to interface with us.
We're still going to control
these channels.
Yeah, we already know about, you know, obviously they've talked about this primarily with Fritz 2, the smartphone initiative, about, you know, we want there to be more sort of potential points of contact between people and our stuff in its various forms. And, you know, broadening that beyond just the dedicated hardware of the moment that may cost quite a lot of money. You know, I mean, this is a weird value proposition to assess, but in some ways, you know, was it like $2 a game? Is it, you know, kind of...
It's actually a great value if you're going to buy all of these games, but you're not going to buy Pac-Man for the NES.
No, I mean, that is a big kind of, you know, landmark game, you know, in video gaming history. And, you know, the NES version, I think, was pretty well regarded at the time. But yeah, in terms of its sort of replayability now, there's just better ways to do that.
Right,
but if you haven't ever bought a virtual console game, I think, but somehow would get something from revisiting this era of game design, there probably is more than that amount of value in there. But in that sense, and of course, you know, you've just got the kind of the nostalgia and the kind of the cool factor of just the fact that it is literally a miniature version of that, you know, classic kind of hardware, you know, design and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it depends what point of view you're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it shows that they've finally committed to kind of mining their back catalog, you know, and putting stuff like this out. Because in the past, when they were selling tons of Wii consoles, they never had any reason to sort of, you know, they could say, eh, you know, we could put more stuff out on VC, but we don't really care.
I think it doesn't really matter. I think their third-party partners. I think the third-party partners at the time were probably appreciative of the fact they weren't dumping on the VC.
Yeah, but now, you know, they're back on their heels a little bit, so they're saying, yeah, well, you know, I feel like kind of like the floodgates have been opened, and they're a lot more open to just kind of saying, yeah, we're going to put our name on a bunch of different products.
Well, and the TG16 stuff may be part of that as well. Like, why we're finally getting it now. Like,
yeah.
Like, let's put them out there. And I do wonder if, like, the branding of this, the branding with Pokemon Go, the integration of all these communications, like how they handled Zelda, which we thought was going to be a train wreck. Like, 3 weeks before E3, we're like, this is going to be the fucking worst E3 we've ever had to cover. Like, their PR has been super on point for the last month and a half.
Mm-hmm. And, well, they haven't had much to do. I'm guessing that their press releases have been polished to a sheen.
That kind of validates the strategy, though, doesn't it? Of only having Zelda at E3, like we said before, you know, it kind of gives them the ability to avoid missteps.
Even this website is absurdly on point, and like they have found ways to really go out there and say, this, you know, this is our history, this is who we are, and you love us for that.
Well, yeah, it's almost like up to now, it's like they've had to be convinced. Like, they didn't actually believe people wanted this stuff.
I wonder if everybody
out here is like, Nintendo, this is easy money. I will buy this shit.
I would say there was a little bit, I think the biggest point at which they really had to be convinced, like that they started to get convinced was, you know, quite a while ago now, was you go back to like the Famicom Mini kind of era, you know, GBA towards the end, the 20th anniversary, of NES / Famicom, that kind of time. That's where, you know, hitherto, you had stuff like giving away games in Animal Crossing. You know, they didn't really demonstrate that they thought this stuff would command a value on the market in any kind of package or whatever. But then, you know, the Famicom Mini stuff happened. Shortly thereafter, Virtual Console happened. You know, and so it's been a kind of gradual process. But I think the biggest distinction that this is showing is what James talked about in terms of the idea of actually disentangling it from a current generation of Nintendo hardware. You know, it's like, it was still very much like, you know, if you want a portal into Nintendo of any era, Nintendo at all, it had to be the dedicated platforms of the moment.
And it's still very controlled here, because they're saying these are your games on this box.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is not, I don't want to overstate the significance of this for sure, but I mean, it does make you wonder about the possibilities in the future in terms of, you know, could they have, I know Johnny talked in the past about, you know, kind of a bit connected to the family systems type of thing, like a sort of pared down portable device that was pretty much just for playing older games or something like that, you know, that presumably would have like internet features or whatever, but almost like a kind of Kindle type of device, but for playing old games, you know, that kind of thing. You wonder whether that could happen if they're going to go with this whole family systems idea, maybe bringing back the NES branding a bit more, as we talked about. If it isn't literally just going to be the name of the whole thing, you know, like NES sort of substituting in for iOS almost, you know, then it could be at least a part of that now as a kind of separate thing where, you know, it's not about, you don't have to own like the full fat console to actually kind of dip into this nostalgia well.
Mm-hmm. But there is a, I mean, if you go back to when they first talked about mobile, they were strident. They were not going to do Virtual Console mobile because the experience would suck.
Yes.
And I think this, we talked about how in mobile there's a sea change there of saying our brands have value away from our systems, but they have value intrinsic on our systems as well that can't be replicated elsewhere. We're not going to try to. We're going to do something different here that uses the value of our brands and uses our skill at creating games to give you value here without reducing the value of our core gameplay on our platforms. I think here, because they've said our Virtual Console games have value, but they really only have value if they're in a way that they are worth playing. So we are going to craft a device that is perfectly suited to playing them. That preys on that nostalgia in a way versus just going, we'll put them out on something and you can play them on whatever you want.
Right. Yep. And yep. The experience was not as simple as this is going to be, you know, like even if you knew that the Wii had virtual console, you had to hook your Wii to the internet. You had to download the thing. You had to, in many cases, buy a special controller for them. Right. Like it was just not meant for that usage.
But also, in terms of the fidelity of the experience, is worth mentioning. Of course, there's you're talking about actually wired controller here.
Yes.
You know, because whereas it's a classic controller type that you plug into a Wii remote, here it plugs straight into the unit that has the little box that's got the HDMI cable running to the telly. So, you know, in that sense, combined with the right kind of lag-free display, you know, you've got HDMI output and, lag-free sort of inputs together. Which you have played some
makes Ninja Gaiden possible.
Well, yeah, Ninja Gaiden, Punch Out. You know, I mean, these are the games where, you know, having played them on Wii U myself, you know, I have noticed the difference. It is real. It's, you know, so I mean, there is that. It may be, obviously, there's a bunch of other ways that you can achieve this, but that's kind of neat too. That you can really kind of replicate. It's not like Punch Out is. You know, it gets down to the nitty gritty of that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
You really do need precise timing to beat some of the more advanced, parts of that game. You know, and I guess to some extent, maybe you can get used to the lag or whatever. But more responsive is better, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing that disappoints me with this: no Mylon Secret Castle.
Oh God!
Conspicuous by its absence.
God damn it!
The conspicuous by its absence.
You know why? You know what, John? Because they're trying to find the ROM and touch every item in the room and couldn't find it.
You know. I mean, maybe I'm hoping. I'm hoping.
You know
that
what?
It comes
maybe it is time for that intervention. All right.
That's good to do
it for email this week. You could send your email to rfn@attenderworldreport.com. Greg, what's our music for this week?
Yep, so this one is a listener request. We've been getting a little influx of listener requests, actually, which I'm very pleased about. Always great to get more people's suggestions, and we'll try and use as many of those over the course of the several weeks. Anytime I'm not driven to put something in because of some special event or whatever else. But this one is from Ben, and he requested the Ball Boss Battle theme, which features in the original Bravely Default, but more prominently in Bravely Second, which you might recognise from you playing that more recently. And it's a lot of fun, so I think this will be a great way to close out the show.
It's a good theme to fight marital chickens against. So, on that, it's time to end the show. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.